Welcome to the Astrophysics Podcast. It was 95 years ago, 1930, when the great Indian physicist Subramanian Chandrasekhar took a trip from India to England and figured out almost everything we know about white dwarf stars. White dwarfs are so dense that the electrons in this star are subject to a quantum mechanical pressure. Heisenberg's uncertainty principle tells us that we can't pin down both the position and momentum of particles in nature. Therefore, if electrons are confined to within a very small space, their momentum has to be very random, which leads to this quantum mechanical pressure called electron degeneracy pressure. Chandrasekhar figured out something else about these electrons. Because of this uncertainty principle, the higher the density of matter, the faster the particles have to be randomly moving until eventually, at high enough density, they are moving close to the speed of light. This is known as the Chandrasekhar limit, and it gives rise to the highest density and therefore the highest mass that a white dwarf star can have while supporting itself against gravity. This maximum mass is about 1.4 times the mass of the Sun. Here's the crazy thing about this. Chandrasekhar figured all of this out without ever having to look through a telescope. He just took what we knew about quantum mechanics and relativity and applied it to white dwarf stars to figure out what we now call the Chandrasekhar limit. Nowadays, we have independent confirmations of this idea. For example, no white dwarf above 1.4 solar mass has ever been detected. And additionally, a very common type of supernova is thought to be caused by the thermonuclear explosion of stars as they reach this Chandrasekhar limit. So we now know that all of these theoretical calculations are solid, but it's incredible to me that we can just sometimes figure out things like this. Just by sitting in an office and applying the known laws of physics to these extreme astrophysical objects. My guest today is Dr. Maxim Lyudikov, a theoretical astrophysicist who also likes to sit in his office thinking about some of the most extreme phenomena in nature. For example, he thinks about neutron stars as dense as the nucleus of an atom, with extremely strong magnetic fields, maybe a trillion times the strength of the Sun's magnetic field. On the Sun, we have bright flares, coronal mass ejections, other types of outflows that we can see on Earth. So what kind of crazy things could be happening on the surface of a neutron star? Let's find out. I'm Paul Duffel, and this is the Astrophysics Podcast. All right. Welcome to the Astrophysics Podcast. My guest today is Dr. Maxim Lyudikov, Professor of Physics and Astronomy at Purdue University. Dr. Lyudikov, thank you for joining me on my little podcast.
My pleasure.
First of all, now, do you remember when we first met?
That was about close to 15 years ago in New York.
That's right.
When you were still a graduate student.
Yes, yeah.
And that was very impressive simulations you showed.
So yeah. I remember it as, like, I'm just working in my office and my advisor comes back and he's just like, you have to... you know, you have to meet this guy and he'll show him this movie you made and stuff like that.
Yes, that was an impressive part of impressive memory. Yes,
but I remembered anyway. I remembered it as my advisor being like, "You need to meet this guy." So for me, it was like, "Oh, this person is somebody important," I guess. I've at least known who you were since I was back in grad school. So that was a long time ago. The first part of this, I just want to get to know how you grew up and that sort of thing, how you got to be a scientist. So let's start by asking, where did you grow up?
Yes, that's kind of important. I grew up in the Soviet Union. I was born in Moscow.
Okay.
And a lot of me becoming a scientist was a part of that. Scientists had a fairly good social standing in the Soviet Union, especially physicists.
Okay.
And that was mostly, almost all of the science in the Soviet Union was tailored for the military.
Right, okay.
And in this sense, so social science, there was very bad for social scientists, and actually for computer science, it was also pretty bad because it was considered as capitalistic science.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I would think the military would be still wanting.
Well, not in the Soviet Union. They are still thinking of something that goes boom. That's the real military.
I see.
And all those zeros and ones are not real military.
I see.
Yes.
Okay.
And then a lot of so physics, of course, was it was realized that physicists are important to teach engineers, and engineers would then make bombs, and so physics was kind of highly regarded.
Okay, so that was sort of the backdrop of you growing up. So back to just generally about Moscow, like how was Moscow itself growing up there?
As a child it was perfect. It was very safe. There was a lot of subsidized activities for kids.
Okay.
And so I was attending an astronomy group, and that astronomy group even went to, in high school, it went to the observatory in Crimea, and it was all kind of subsidized partially by the state.
Right, right.
So that was pretty good in this
sense. That's nice.
Yeah, I also had an interesting, the reason why I became interested in astrophysics, I had an interesting kind of coincidence.
Okay.
My parents were really outdoor people, and extreme outdoors. So
okay.
they would go on kayaking trips, and the longest took 40 days.
Okay, that's serious.
800 kilometers with a portage over Ural Mountains. And on these long trips, of course, there is a lot of things to do physically, meaning you pack, you unpack, you paddle.
Right.
But very quickly you run out of mental challenges. And then it happened that one of the, well, usually it's just wild campsite, but somehow at one point we, you know, there was a old fireplace where we stopped. And maybe second or third week into this trip, I found an astronomy textbook.
Just sitting on the ground?
Just, yeah, laying on the ground.
Okay.
And that's, you know, it's in Taiga, that's in Asia, in close to the polar circle. And that astronomy textbook provided me with intellectual kind of entertainment for the rest of my trip.
Oh, I see. Because you hadn't brought anything like that with you.
Yes.
So you had this textbook.
Yes.
That's all you have to read.
Right, right. So I read it a few times over.
Wow.
And I was 12 or 13 then.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the start of my interest in astronomy. So when I came back to town, I started attending all these astronomy events.
Okay. So you mentioned your parents were big, very outdoorsy. What did they do for a living?
My father was a nuclear engineer in a nuclear research institute, and that nuclear was always in the Soviet Union, had some non-military part, but mostly it was for the military.
Right.
So his work was he was designing power supplies based on nuclear nuclear-based
right.
power supplies.
Okay.
So, and one of his device flew to the moon. But also he was designing, you know, for submarines, because the submarines need to be sometimes underwater for months, and in order to orient them, you know, without surfacing, they would drop buoys onto the floor, on the ocean floor, that would try to transmit some kind of signal for the submarine to reorient itself.
Right, okay.
And those buoys were powered, nuclear powered, and that's what designing. Yes.
Wow. So now that's, you know, it's funny, you have this this backdrop of the Soviet Union having a scientist, and particularly physicists, having high standing in society, and you're also, your father is a nuclear engineer. But the thing that you pointed to as being immediately driving you in that direction was finding this textbook on the ground, when you had all these other influences too, right?
Not really, because my father would rarely talk about work at home.
I see.
And actually, though the status was kind of high, but not very high, the status of physicists. For example, until the age of 15, we lived in a studio apartment in Moscow. You know, just to think about a nuclear engineer, and we didn't have a car.
Right.
A nuclear engineer could not afford anything beyond a studio apartment.
I see.
But it was an apartment. Yes.
Right. Okay, so then I had all these questions about like how you got first excited about astrophysics. But so the beginning of that is that textbook, and then because that was about astronomy. So then did you carry that the whole time with you, this idea that you wanted to do astrophysics, or?
Right, and I'm a bit surprised that, so I got infatuated with astrophysics at the age of 12, right. And I carried it through. I went to also Nuclear Engineering Institute. That was very good, and my goal was always to, you know, do some kind of flip and return, go to astrophysics in the end.
I see. So what we would describe as majoring in physics or something, but you had this plan that it was always going to lead towards astrophysics.
Right.
Okay, and then, well, maybe we should continue that thought of where. So then, you when did you eventually come over to the States?
Oh, that's yes. So, in a nuclear research institute, I had military clearance.
Okay,
and at that time, in order to leave the Soviet Union, just to go abroad, you need to get what was called exit visa. You could not just go.
Okay.
And the year before I left for the United States, I wasn't allowed to go to Poland because of the military clearance. But then in 92, the Soviet Union collapsed, and I got accepted to Caltech, and wow. I went, and nobody cared.
What do you mean? That's pretty amazing timing, though, right?
Right.
But what do you mean by nobody cared?
Well, when I told my friends that I'm applying for graduate studies in the U.S., my friends told me, you know, you have military clearance. They will pick you up off the plane, and your parents will not find your bones in Siberia. So that I was really in the first wave of people who were able to leave, because actually, you know, paying for the TOEFL or GRE, there was no free exchange at that time.
Right.
So it was done through the American embassy.
I see. And so, in other words, there was like, there's maybe some anxiety that something was going to happen, that you wouldn't be able to get off the plane or something like that, but you're saying nobody cared. You just got off the plane and everything was fine.
Right.
And so then you started at Caltech. So that was, you did graduate school there.
Right.
When do you feel, this is another question on my list, when do you feel like you first learned how to become a scientist?
I guess close to the end of my graduate studies.
Okay.
And so my advisor, Roger Blanford, he was very busy. He would fly to Washington, red eyes, like every week or so. He was mm-hmm. on all the committees. He gave me a lot of freedom in pursuing what I thought was interesting.
Right.
And on the other hand, I probably didn't learn from him as much as I could have if our collaboration were closer. Mm-hmm. But then he gave me a lot of freedom and freedom to explore. And of course, in the beginning, as a first, second, or maybe third year graduate student, the way you think is different. You think in terms of well-posed problems that you need to find a solution. And only maybe in the third or fourth year, I started to develop independent thinking, kind of setting up problems for myself.
Right.
As opposed to doing something that my advisor told me.
Right.
And I think that it was a good, reasonable progress in a sense that a graduate student is supposed to, you know, do something that advisor first told him. And then by the end of his studies, her studies, a person should learn to set up problems for himself or for,
right.
herself. And then as a postdoc, you solve the problems that you did for yourself. You set up for yourself, and then later on, if you become a professor, you are at a level that you can tell other people what to do. So, I think I kind of followed this trajectory with some little deviations.
Right. But, yeah. I mean, it's definitely. I mean, I think that is, and that's basically what you're supposed to be learning. You're a student still, right? So that's what you are supposed to be learning how to do. Right.
And so. One of my criteria now with students is that after second or third year, they will not ask me what I should do next, what they should do next.
Okay.
Hoping that after maybe third year, they already understand and they have enough knowledge and they can orient themselves in the problems that are interesting. And so what they mm-hmm. learn from me in the first three, say, years is enough for them to try to do independent steps in the year four and five.
Yeah. Right. And a lot of times it's just a matter of if they ask you, what do I do next? You just tell them, you already know. you know the answer to that is within you somewhere.
No, I don't think so, because the very question, what I do next,
yes.
is basically it's a wrong question.
Right.
A little bit of a wrong question.
Yeah.
And in this sense, I remember my first two graduate students. One was very good mathematically, and he could solve all the equations that I tell him to do. But his attitude was that I am the boss, and he has to do what I ask him to.
Yes.
And very often he would be shy to ask a question.
Yeah.
And very often he would, you know, come into my office kind of obviously underslept, and he would tell me though, I cannot do this, something doesn't match. And then we talk, and 10 minutes later we understand what's the problem. Mm-hmm. And my other student, he was less, initially, he was less mathematically strong, but he would just walk into my office and would ask questions.
Right.
And in the end, both of them succeeded in their own way.
Right.
But, you know, asking questions and be relaxed with your advisors is a very important thing. And in Caltech, I worked a little bit with Kip Thorne. Mm-hmm. And when I, you know, already as a professor, I told him this kind of story of, you know, one student being too respectful of the professor.
Right.
And Kip Thorne told me that, and I still remember that, so quote, A student must be disrespectful of his professor in a good way. So this is exactly the words that Kip Thorne says. So disrespectful in a good way, meaning to challenge and to treat it as a collaborative effort and not as the boss and a worker.
Yeah, I think that that's two. I think you pointed to two things that, as a society, we set up that you have to constantly fight against. One is that professors are they know everything and that they're supposed to teach everyone else things, that like they're on top and they're the boss and sort of as a society, like maybe not as a general society, but once you walk into a college, like that's sort of how professors are often treated and they shouldn't be. Right? Yeah. But then also what you mentioned about asking questions, in all other areas of their life, they're almost usually punished for asking questions because it shows that they don't know something, right? And so nobody wants to admit they're ignorant of something or they don't know things. And so, but once you're in academics, you have to admit, you have to be able to ask those questions. Otherwise you can't get through that barrier.
Right, right. And, another subtle point here is that at the undergraduate level, the students always compete with their peers because they're always ranked by their academic, basically by their test scores. Mm-hmm. While in research, you may compete with other groups, but you have to collaborate with a person sitting next to you in a laboratory,
right?
And in a graduate class,
right?
So that's I'm really trying to encourage my graduate students to talk to each other. Because sometimes
right.
You may know something, a person may know something. And talking to each other often leads to discoveries for both.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when I first started grad school, I didn't really know anything about programming, but Jonathan's Rake, who was my office mate and also shared an advisor with me, he knew all kinds of things about programming. And so because we talked to each other, like I was able to write all these great codes and, learned so much. Like I wouldn't have been able to do that if I didn't talk to anybody, if I just tried to do it all on my own and tried to make sure that I was better than other people. I had to admit that there were things I didn't know that other people did. But yeah, I totally agree with that. So now you're an astrophysicist. What parts of the job would you say you like the most?
Intellectual challenges. Right, yes. So it's the working of the mind that gives pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
And I do theoretical astrophysics, so neutron stars, black holes, and finding new physical effects of realizing, understanding some observations. In the end, it's all intellectual challenges that I don't know what's the chemical process that thinking gives us pleasures, mm-hmm. but there must be some kind of chemical reaction that that is produced while you are thinking and that gives you pleasure.
Even when I'm just planning my lectures for class, right, thinking through the process, and it's just
right.
Even when it's not something that's like as intense as doing like new research, it's still like it's just an enjoyable experience.
Right. Yeah. Then probably solving crosswords gives you the same
right,
pleasure, but
right.
except that here it's a little bit more tangible
when you're
researching physics, and especially in astrophysics, because I got infatuated with astrophysics at the age of 12, and I'm still infatuated with astrophysics at my age of 55, and thinking about black holes and neutron stars and all this very interesting and often counterintuitive processes and effects.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, is there anything you don't like about your job?
Oh, well, spending time on writing numerous proposals with a low success rate.
Yeah, that's my answer too.
Yes, no, that's a pretty straightforward.
Okay.
But actually, I have to this story, to this question, I have a little story. Once I read Galileo's Memories.
Okay.
And so most of his work Galileo did when he was in Padua. Padua and Venice was part of Padua. Mm-hmm. And Padua was a republic.
Okay.
But Galileo wanted to go back to Florence and Pisa. And Tuscany was a kingdom.
Okay.
And in one of the letters Galileo wrote to one of the Medicis, where he said that while he is in the Republic, nobody, well, I don't remember the exact phrasing, but basically he said in the Republic he has to teach the students and do service.
Okay.
While according to him, only in only a king can provide a scientist with freedom.
Right, right. And of course, just tells you go do whatever you want.
Right, and of course he was wrong because in the end. It's within the so he did go back to Tuscany, and some scholars think that if he stayed in the Republic, he would have never been persecuted.
Oh,
but because he went to the kingdom,
so
he was so. And going back to our situation. It's, yes, writing grants and teaching students is our responsibilities, mm-hmm. but that's what gives us freedom to do our research, because the alternative is, you know, it could be wrong as Galileo was wrong.
Right, right. So, yeah, to be careful of funding sources too good to be true, right?
Yes.
It yeah. seems all perfect.
Right.
But, if there's no exchange, if you're not providing a service, then, you know, that you could imagine just one day it turns sour.
Yes.
That's a very insightful way of thinking about it. Before we talk specifically about science, would you say there's any? What would you say were? I guess the most challenging parts. You had obviously many different challenging stages to your trajectory, and different. And you know, you've spent a large part of the Soviet Union, a large part of it here. So, what would you say was like the most challenging part of of your time in academia?
The most challenging. Somehow things went more or less smoothly for me.
Mm-hmm.
And not in the sense that it was easy to find a job or, but because somehow I was always sure that things will work out internally in my mind. I was sure that I need to do good work and it will, you know, pay back.
Right.
So I was a little bit naive, but it kind of worked out
right.
in the end.
So, I mean, anybody I will end up talking to that's a professor, it ends up working out for them, right? So,
then, for example, people tell me, oh, at one point when I got tenured, they tell me, oh, now you can relax. And I said, no, well, I was always relaxed.
Right, right.
Yeah, so yeah. There is some subtleties in attitudes.
I do take that attitude with tenure that I focus on doing good work and not worrying too much about, like, if I'm satisfying, like, if every bullet point that I could possibly get, you know, ticked off, you know, get not quite enough points on or something like that. So I do take that attitude with tenure too. But it is it's, you know, just do your best job, and you know, good things will come.
Right. Enjoy doing your best job.
Right.
And things will come. Yes.
Right. Because I mean, that's the thing. Is like, so there are some things that are out of your control. So if there's, you know, no need to get stressed about those sorts of things.
But of course, as almost everyone, I did try a little bit. You know, took some finance courses.
Mm.
That wasn't intellectually challenging enough for me.
I see.
Yeah,
but you had an out. You could have gone into finance or something like that.
Many of my colleagues and peers, they do went into finance and now have private jets and things like that.
But they don't have the same intellectual challenges that you get to have.
No, actually, they talking
they
to them,
do?
They say yes.
Okay.
It's the intellectual challenges that attract them most to their finance job.
All right. Well, maybe I should interview some finance people.
Yeah.
All right. So that's the first part. Why don't we're going to shift gears into talking about what this type of science you work on. So I'll start by asking this question, which is, when you meet a new graduate student or fellow scientist and they ask what you work on, what do you tell them?
I do plasma astrophysics. So in my undergraduate institution, I did thermonuclear fusion, tokamaks. I wanted to do astrophysics, but I was prohibited from doing astrophysics by the dean of my university. It was really strange.
Okay.
It was really strange that a dean would get involved on a personal level and telling undergraduates, the second year undergraduate student, what he can or cannot do.
Okay. Dean had some personal problem with it, or
that was a little bit strange, and I cannot really talk about these things. It was somehow it got involved with some controversies at the highest level, like with the very strange, very strange. But anyway, so I wanted to do astrophysics, but I was prohibited. And then I asked, what do you want me to do? And he said, plasma physics. And I thought, okay, a lot of astrophysics is plasma, so I will go and do undergraduate research in plasmas, and then switch back to astrophysics. And that's indeed how it happened.
So that's good. So first of all, let's describe what is a plasma.
Yes. So most of the matter in the universe is plasma. And plasma is, you probably know that, so air molecules, well, air consists of molecules. Molecules consist of atoms. Atoms consist of nucleus and electrons. So if you heat a material to very high temperatures, then you can tear off that electron that is running around. Well, it's not really running around. It's sitting there around the atom, around the nucleus. But you, if the temperature is very high, you can tear off that electron. And then instead of neutral molecules and atoms, you have a soup of charged particles.
Okay.
Electrons and protons, and those charged particles, they interact through what is called Coulomb forces. And the biggest issue there is that Coulomb forces are very long-range forces, meaning one particle can interact with many at the same time. So, for example, in the air, most of the molecules, they fly freely for a long time, and then sometimes they collide with another one. So
right.
It's just pair interaction. While in plasma, you have one particle interacting with many at the same time, and that brings some interesting complexities, okay. collective effects.
So just to summarize, you have, you know, if you take a normal gas like the air in this room and you heat it up to a hot enough temperature, all of the, well, first of all the molecules split apart into atoms, but then the, also the atoms split apart, so the well, not the nucleus, but the electron gets torn off of each atom, or all the electrons in principle get torn off of all the atoms, so that it's just a bunch of nuclei and electrons just flying around. And because these are charged particles, they're interacting with each other, with many, many other particles at all times. And so it's, first of all, extremely complex problem, as opposed to a gas that where you only have to think about particles as just being independent and then colliding every so often.
Right.
And so that makes it a much more complex thing in principle. But then it's, of course, has many applications, both in nuclear engineering, and you need to get the inside of tokamak reactors. You have hot plasma that you needs to be confined in certain ways, and so we need to understand how that works.
Right. Yeah. So tokamak is they call it sometimes a sun in the laboratory. So the hope is that if you can confine the the plasma, if you want to make a sun in the laboratory to produce energy from thermonuclear fusion, you need to confine that hot plasma, and that it's very hard, turns out to be to confine. Mm-hmm. But there are processes that occurring in this laboratory device and in astrophysics. There are some similarities, and of course, most of material in the universe is ionized, so it's plasma. And there are so many applications of plasma physics to so various areas of research in astrophysics.
So I like that you made that connection by saying that a tokamak reactor is like a sun in a laboratory, because that sort of tells you, like, you can work on this, and then you can, that also tells you a little bit, at least, about how to understand how stars work, for example. Or at least that's because the sun is made out of plasma.
Yes.
Or at least to some extent it tells you some things about that. But so, okay, so you transitioned from that into plasma astrophysics, and you were about to talk about examples of situations where you need to where plasmas are important in astrophysics.
Well, most of the universe is plasma, so
right.
Plasma is important for all parts of astrophysics.
Okay.
But my particular interest is generation of coherent emission. Basically, we observe that some of the astrophysical sources produce very powerful radio emission.
Mm-hmm.
And they work as basically some kind of radio station.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually a very difficult question how they do that.
Right.
Because unlike many other problems where you can do little tilde estimates and you can start with overall your energy balance and do some tilde estimates from that. When you're thinking about generation of radio waves, basically you need to add several waves so that the humps add together and the troughs also add together. So that's called coherent. So basically then you are talking about adding phases. And phase is kind of dimensionless quantity, and it's hard to argue from basic properties, from density or temperature, how you can add a phase together coherently. It depends on very subtle properties of plasma.
So let me back to track a little bit and to sort of summarize what you said, which is, or maybe rephrase what you said. Like if you take if you wanted to generically produce some luminosity, like the luminosity from the sun or something, some, you know, thermal radiation, you can estimate, you know, what that luminosity would be if you knew certain, you know, bulk properties of the matter. And a lot of that is because it's produced by particles that are just moving around randomly, essentially. And so it's kind of an incoherent emission. And so if you're just talking about something that's incoherent, it's sort of, you can estimate things more simply. But with coherent emission, it's almost like, it's almost like somebody made this emission, right? It's almost like it's engineered to behave in this way. And so it's a lot harder to figure out how to make that emission source.
Right. Yeah. So the radio was invented about, 130 years ago. And fire was invented millennia ago. So it's hard to produce radio waves. You need some kind of device that you then fine tune.
Right.
And in the laboratory, there is an engineer that can fine tune the properties of your device. But in astrophysical setting, this fine tuning should occur naturally.
Right.
And it's almost a contradiction. What do you mean fine tuning occurring naturally? Yes, that's the problem. How very subtle fine tuning. So we're talking about radio waves, which is about a centimeter. So you need to add billions of waves within a millimeter of a phase. Billions and billions of waves, and that should occur naturally without any engineer fine tuning the.
So it's sort of like when we first discovered pulsars. There were people who were like, nothing could make something like that. It's too regular. It's too perfect. And it was hard to imagine like what could produce such nice, not only it's first of all the perfect periods, but also the coherent emission from pulsars. And maybe you're going to correct me on this, but the fact that it's a neutron star that just with a strong magnetic field can do this, that's rotating, the fact that you can do that, that nature just naturally forms something like that, is kind of incredible, because it looks like something that a person did.
Yeah. Well, let's separate here two issues. Mm-hmm. So first we detected pulsars, and pulsars is you get radio emission every second. Mm-hmm. And from that time scale, 1 second, you already can do some estimates of the properties of the source. Mm-hmm. And for example, that 1 second tells you that the source should be very, very dense. Mm-hmm. It's a bit of a strange logic. How can you, from 1 second, how can you go to density? But, there are... this is one of those, you can do a little tilde estimate that will tell you that a source that produces periodic emission with 1 second should be very, very dense. Mm-hmm. And that's identified neutron stars as the source. But then there is a question how those neutron stars produce that coherent radio emission. And we are still not sure.
Right.
And
So we understand why the 1 second period, but then if you just look at a single pulse, how does that, if you just identify one pulse from it, how does that one pulse get created itself?
Right. So, and in my presentations, when I first did my first presentation as a graduate student, the opening line was, pulses were discovered 25 years ago, but still we're not sure how they produce radio emission. And then as the years progress, the opening line was, the pulses were discovered 30, 35. And by now I changed that line, that pulses were discovered many years ago, but we're still not sure.
You don't have to keep updating your PowerPoint.
Right.
Good. So, okay. So anyway, the point is coherent source. So pulsar could be an example of a source that produces really coherent emission and uses plasmas to do that somehow. And it's still the details of exactly how that works are still an open question, but it's something you work on.
Yes, that's my biggest challenge. And these things became even more interesting over the last few years, when a kind of absolutely an amazing new phenomenon was discovered called fast radio bursts. Mm-hmm. And those are truly amazing. It's a burst of just 1 millisecond long. You know, a human cannot produce such a short. It's beyond our nervous reaction. So it's extremely short radio pulse that mm-hmm. comes from halfway across the observed universe. So it's extremely powerful. Mm-hmm. And those are coherent pulses and just one of those, you know, infatuations with astrophysics. And here is another example of a very interesting question. Extremely short and extremely bright pulse that comes halfway across the universe.
Right.
And probably they are related somehow also to neutron stars. But those pulses are, again, a billion times more powerful than what we observe from regular pulsars.
Okay, I see. So you imagine that it's somehow similar to the fact that you can make coherent emission from pulsars, but it's so much more powerful that you have to think, like, how does it scale up like that? And what, is this just the crazy things that happen every once in a while? Or is this...
They happen very often. In the whole universe, they happen about 10,000 times per day.
10,000 times per day?
Right.
But wow. It's in the whole... we only catch a few of them.
But we only catch a few, maybe one every month. Because typically radio telescopes have very small field of view. And many of those sources are non-repeating. So... Mm-hmm. There are some repeating ones that would produce, they produce randomly the bursts, but mm-hmm. still they repeat. Mm-hmm. But most of them are non-repeating, and it's very, and something that is non-repeating and just does a short blip is very hard to observe.
Right.
Right,
you don't know where to look.
You don't know where to look, and, if you have a usually powerful radio telescopes have very small field of view, but if you don't know where to look, it's kind of hard to justify that you should get observing time because
I'm just going to point this telescope in a direction.
Yeah, if you're
going to
point the telescope into the empty sky and wait for, but slowly people got some statistics. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so these radio bursts, they're frequent, but they're observed very rarely because of these observational constraints. They do not carry much energy with them. Not much. It stands to become is a relative. So mm-hmm. during this millisecond, the power maybe as billions of the suns, but it's only for 1 millisecond the luminosity.
Right.
So very interesting objects, and again, as I said, they are probably related to special type of neutron stars, highly magnetized neutron stars. But again, how they do this, that's one of the challenges that I'm trying to overcome.
All right.
And understand.
So how do you, my next question is basically what your research kind of looks like day to day. In other words, how do you approach a problem like that? It's such a very general question of like, how do you make a mission like this, right? How does something produce a plasma, how does a plasma or something produce coherent, powerful emission over a millisecond like that? So how do you even start on a problem like that?
Well, there are basic ideas. There are actually not that many basic ideas. There is basic ideas. I mean the principles, mm-hmm. and one of the principles is kind of how the radio works. Mm-hmm. There are other possibilities. For example, they're mostly all of these possibilities have some kind of laboratory analogs.
Mm-hmm.
For example, there is lately meaning in the last 20, 30 years, there are devices called free electron lasers that mm-hmm. produce coherent emission in X-rays.
Okay.
And that's really truly amazing because in X-rays the wavelength is extremely short, and yet this laboratory device can add those X-ray waves coherently. And so there are a few basic principles that might work, and probably they work in some different settings, but one of the challenges again is in a laboratory there is an engineer that can fine-tune the properties of your system,
mm-hmm.
while I'm trying to think how those special conditions can be achieved on their own by a system,
right.
That is something that happens in a system without interference of engineer. And I more or less know what kind of effect should happen mm-hmm. to produce a coherent emission. And then I'm trying to see how that, particular distribution may develop.
So, in other words, because we're humans, you know, we learn about things by looking at other things, and so we see, you know, you can, by analogy, see how they do this sort of thing in laboratories and try to think about how you might develop, how you might engineer something like that naturally happens in space. I guess what I was going to ask is, what's an example of something like of a situation that you think would produce that you think is or a good candidate for what produces that emission?
It should be some kind of a laser.
Okay.
And the way lasers work is, they produce coherent emission,
mm-hmm.
and. Radio also produces coherent emission. That's another example. In a radio, and typically the way it happens in the laser, you create an engineer in a laboratory creates a situation when it's called population inversion, when there is a lot of particles sitting in a special state when they want to emit.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is a little perturbation that comes in and kind of shakes all those particles that want to emit. And this little perturbation makes all of those particles, it makes them emit, and it turns out that they emit all in phase. And that's the kind of qualitative description of how lasers work. An important point here is how you create such a state because typically there is more particle that ready to absorb than to emit. But in a laser, you have to create a special state,
right?
As I say, population inversion, when there is more particle ready to emit than absorb.
And you set up, and it's presumably you'll have some kind of crystal or something like that. You set it up in such a way where everything is spaced right, and the particles are all, and you set them, they all are absorbing enough radiation at the right frequency that they're all at this state where they're ready to emit.
Yeah. So and there should be some special. It's called distribution function,
mm-hmm.
Non-thermal, mm-hmm. and.
Right. So you can't have particles that are just randomly.
Right.
One should create
somehow this special distribution, and then there is a question: how is that special distribution created? And then there are many issues. with coherence.
Okay, and so that gives at least gives a sense of the challenges of how you would do that in nature,
right? But most importantly, it's those special distribution can be a very it's a very small deviation from an equilibrium. Small deviation kind of in absolute values, so the number of particles that are not in what's called normal state may be very small compared to the total number of particles. Mm-hmm. But those few will eventually produce a very powerful, bright radio emission.
Okay.
So it's a very subtle game.
So then in nature, like I guess if assuming it's produced by a neutron star or something, is this still just a totally open question? How do we get particles into such a configuration like that? Like what is the mechanism?
Most likely, what happens is a laser, but a laser, there is kind of special distribution when there is more particles ready to emit, mm-hmm. but that special distribution is kind of continuous, meaning, for example, if you have a beam of particles, charged particles going through plasma, that beam is already an example of a non-equilibrium distribution, and that beam under certain condition may produce a coherent emission.
Is it just because it's in a beam, so it's in kind of an ordered state as it enters the plasma?
Right. So there is a beam that goes through, then probably that beam should be accelerated by electric fields. Mm-hmm. So then there is an electric field that accelerates the beam. And actually, there is a good example of what I'm talking about is a fire hose.
Okay.
So if you imagine a fire hose, and if you start pumping water, the water at not very high rates, the water just flows through a hose and nothing happens.
Okay.
But then, as you probably all know, if you push the water strong enough, the hose starts dancing around.
Right.
And that's an example of how a flow of particles, a flow of water, produced waves. In this case, the fire hose, the wave that you produce is this oscillations of your hose.
Right.
But in case of plasmas, those will be charged particles producing electromagnetic waves, which are also oscillations. So that's a kind of an example how a beam can produce a wave.
Okay. So then what is the beam in a neutron star?
Probably there is a process called magnetic reconnection. Mm-hmm. And this process involves a magnetic field. And magnetic field with kind of reversing polarity. If, say, at one point magnetic field is points up, and in the other nearby location it's points down, those two counter-aligned magnetic fields, they want to kind of they don't like each other, and they start fighting, and that fighting produces eventually it produces electric fields, the process of reconnection, and those electric fields accelerate beams of charged particles, that and those charged particles somehow produce coherent emission and through various processes.
Magnetic reconnection also happens in the sun.
Right. It happens in the sun. It happens in the Earth magnetosphere. So Earth has a magnetic field. And that magnetic field protects the Earth from the charged particles in the solar wind. And that boundary between the Earth magnetosphere and the solar wind is about a 10 Earth radii. And solar wind also carries a magnetic field. And sometimes the field from the solar wind kind of reconnects with the field from the Earth's magnetosphere, and that produces interesting effects like aurora borealis. Yeah,
okay.
That's an example of reconnection producing a beam of charged particles, and then those charged particles stream along magnetic field and then precipitate in the Earth atmosphere, ionize atoms, and produce effects of aurora borealis.
So the aurora borealis, is that coherent emission?
No, it's not coherent.
Oh, I was so hopeful that would be a perfect analogy.
There are some low frequency coherent emission in the Earth magnetosphere, but no, aurora borealis is just excitation of neutral atoms.
Okay.
But there is a lot of interesting low frequency hiss, and it's actually a scientific term, a hiss.
Is it?
Yes, so it's low frequency hiss that these particles also produce kind of fluctuating magnetic fields. In radio,
I wanted to say something about, so magnetic reconnection in the sun is that the source of the solar wind, or is it charged particles that get fly out from?
Yes, so reconnection on the sun, reconnection occurs on the sun, and sometimes it produces big explosions called coronal mass ejections.
Right.
And these are big blobs of plasma that are flying out in the space, and sometimes they hit the Earth, and those can be really bad for a lot of electrical device on Earth. And there was a big one in early 1980s that led to a blackout in the province of Quebec. But in addition to these rare big events, well, those big events are not that rare, but most of them happily miss the Earth.
Right.
Sometimes they hit the Earth and they cause a lot of trouble, but most of the time they fly out. But in addition, it is believed that many small micro flares produce what is known as a solar wind.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of micro reconnection events that are occurring constantly, or approximately constantly, produce this effect of the solar wind.
Okay. And then, so that actually makes me think about this, the sun, has all these little reconnection events, it has big ones that create these dramatic ejections. So obviously we know the magnetic reconnection is an effect that occurs whenever you have a body with a magnetic field like that. And so, like, part of this is a matter of sort of scaling that up and thinking, how big of a reconnection event can you get, and can you get something that would produce a fast radio burst if it was a neutron star with a really strong magnetic field?
Right, yes. And I actually have a little paper called The Solar Physics of Magnetars, and that's exactly the idea that I'm trying to work out. That is to generalize what we know and we observe happening on the sun, magnetic reconnection events, to a very different environment of super strongly magnetized relativistic plasmas that we find near neutron stars, and also those plasmas electron positron plasmas as opposed to electron ion plasma in the solar corona. But yes, these are the general conceptual ideas that I'm working on.
Great. Let me ask if there's that actually summarized it pretty well, so I'm not sure I should ask another question. but is there, let me actually shift gears and ask this question, because I think that covers the topics you're most excited about right now. But let me ask, in your opinion, why should we care about astrophysics at all?
Oh, yes. Many people think that what we are doing is something esoteric. It's actually, in many respects, it's very practical. For example, understanding Reconnection on the sun has huge effects on how we on the functioning of our society on the earth. And the example with big blackout caused by solar flare is how it affects directly. And even in a more concept in a stranger examples, for example, general theory of relativity, you may think that it's a very strange one. So general theory of relativity says that there is no gravitational acceleration, there is a curved space, and you may think, well, that kind of ridiculous, but even if it's true, it doesn't affect me. No, it does, because the effects of general relativity are the primary corrections to the GPS.
Right.
The errors due to the general effect of general relativity is something like 10 kilometers per day, while your GPS, you know, military GPS, can do the 10 centimeters.
Yes.
So there is a lot of things that most people do not realize that actually came from astrophysics. And actually, Wi-Fi was developed as an astronomical technique. So these things are all connected, and you cannot do just practical things. You need to do fundamental research as well.
Right. I mean, as you say, if you understand how plasmas work better, there, you know, you understand how to develop a better nuclear reactor.
Something like that. These things are all connected.
Right. Yeah. Right. Okay. So, is there a next big exciting thing that you're looking forward to in astrophysics?
I think I'm kind of a little bit saturated, because I'm trying to look at very difficult issues that do not typically have one simple solution.
Right.
So I think I'm okay for the few years to come.
you're happy to work on problems that won't be solved for decades.
Right. Yes. Yes. I'll take my chance. Yes.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Lyudikov. I had a lot of fun talking science with you, and I hope you'll join me again sometime.
Very good. Thank you very much. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad the Russian government didn't detain him, and we got to have Maxim Lyudikov come join us on our side of the Iron Curtain. It's always interesting to hear about personal stories interacting with our history. So thank you so much to Dr. Lyudikov, and thank you to our listeners. We will see you next time. The Astrophysics Podcast is supported in part by the National Science Foundation under grant number AAG-2206-299. If you want to connect more, if you have astronomy or astrophysics questions, follow me on Blue Sky at paulduffel.bsky.social. This music and all the music you hear on the Astrophysics Podcast was written and recorded by Britton Ashford, and you can find it on her album Trotter. All songs are used with permission from the artist and producer. Check it out if you enjoyed the music. This podcast is produced in beautiful Lafayette, Indiana by me, Paul Duffel, Professor of Physics and Astronomy at Purdue University.